You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is May 4th, 2016, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
May the 4th be with you.
And also with you,
always, always. No. And also with you is Catholic, Jay. For Jedi, you say, may the Force be with you always.
May the Force be with you always.
Yes. May the 4th. May the 4th is not only Star Wars Day. It is the anniversary of the first SGU episode
ever.
May 4th, 2005. This is our 11-year anniversary.
Crap, where we
holy
are
crap,
old.
You guys.
Whereas, has the time
as Evan
gone.
Said, 11-tees.
You guys started 1 year after I graduated from college.
That's awesome.
That's crazy.
Could you imagine, though, guys? I mean, seriously, 11 years. Like, talk about our lives being very different and what a ride we've been on since the show started.
Yeah, it's been awesome. You guys want to hear some stats?
Yep.
Yeah.
Love to.
Sure.
All-time downloads. How many times has the SGU been downloaded in 11 years?
78.
71.
70 million.
70 million.
Wow.
We're getting about 1 million downloads a month now. Each of our most recent episodes is peaking at about 155,000. So that's about how many listeners we have per episode. And if you break it down by country, guess what percentage of our listeners are in the United States?
70%.
73%.
68%.
55%.
That's it?
Lower than all. Oh. Yeah, so we have a much more international audience.
That's amazing.
You may have thought.
Yeah.
UK is 11%, then Australia at 8.7, Canada at 8.2, and then everyone else is 16% total. But after Canada, guess which country comes after Canada?
Australia.
No, he already said Australia.
USA, UK, Australia, Canada, and then what's number five?
Sweden.
Sweden.
Sweden, yeah. How'd you know?
I don't know.
Well, just I was there. Sweden's... I mean, I know everything.
Sweden's always been kind of high in our
It's the
demo.
First non-English-speaking country, you know, as their primary language on our list.
Although probably everybody there speaks English.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, it's not their primary language.
Are they an atheist country, Sweden, historically?
I would think that they're moving more towards atheism.
Yeah. They're Viking, aren't they?
Yeah, but they're not atheist. They're not. I wouldn't consider them an atheist country, no.
That they worship Thor and Odin and those guys.
Yeah, right. Because if you're going to believe in a god, make the god be cool as balls, right?
Yeah. Right. I totally go for Thor. Yeah. It's interesting. Right as we're starting to record the show, somebody sent us a poem for our 11th anniversary. So how could we not read it? Jay, you're going to start us off.
This is a poem by Olivia Walser. And the title is Battle of Logos. You have a propensity for verbosity. It's a useful proclivity. Those not possessing, we pity.
These inclinations bring us to our destinations, far from brain frustrations, nearer to mental vacations.
Perceived as overthought, pessimism, or being distraught, we're just trying to figure out what this or that thing is all about.
Catch them if you can. They always tend to get out of hand. A straw man without a brain, busted up for useless gain. A red herring sings a strong song. It sounds lovely, but it's wrong.
A flash of electrical connections of neural warriors' objections, then triumphant eardrums roll when reason reaches the goal.
Eyes aglow with thought, logic's battle done fought. False conclusion, wave white flags, fallacies reduced to rags.
Ooh, I love it. It's so badass.
Yeah. Oh, E.E. Cummings, eat your heart out.
Yeah.
Go to the SGU's Facebook page and see the new image that includes Kara with
That's
us
me.
And read that poem. Read
oh,
that
seriously.
Poem. Seriously. When you're, right, Bob? Read the poem. That's an
Learn
old
that poem.
That was from Little Rascals.
Little Rascals.
The Little Rascals
That's
learned.
Right.
It was read that poem.
No,
learn that poem. Anyway, read the poem as
if
you look
40
at,
or under,
at the new image that I put up there of all of us, because it's kind of serious, and we're very serious in that picture.
Oh, yes.
Love it.
That picture is propaganda, Jay.
Uh-oh. I feel a
yes,
segue
thank you.
Coming on.
It's total propaganda, right? I could use that word any way I want
Props.
To. Words mean exactly what I want them to mean, right, Kara?
Yes, exactly. Well, guys, I thought that this week, actually, Steve recommended, and I think it's a great recommendation, that we follow up on an email for this week's What's the Word. Now, I got an email from Ryan Ciuffetelli. That's how he says he pronounces it. I think that's right, Ciuffetelli. And he says, hi, SGU, obligatory nice things, nice things, nice things, blah, blah, blah. And propaganda is one of many terms with a significant gap in the definition and what much of the public thinks it means. Usually it is utilized by a group or member of one ideology in describing the public statements of an opposing ideology. Further, many people learn about it in history class when studying messages governments send to their citizens during wartime. In the US, this often means Nazi and Japanese propaganda during World War II. Unfortunately, I believe this leads to the assumption that propaganda is by definition false. Most definitions of propaganda I found include any statement designed to further some sort of cause. This definition is troubling, as it would render almost any persuasive speech as propaganda, which is certainly not the common connotation. So I think if we are to use the word propaganda, we should define it specifically, least of all so we know what we're talking about, and possibly that we ensure it cannot be accurately used against us. So I thought I would take a minute to actually look up probably the two most trusted sources and what their definition of propaganda are. And so I'm citing here Merriam-Webster's dictionary and also the Oxford dictionaries. And between the two of them, I'm seeing the full definition of propaganda is the spreading of ideas, information, or rumor for the purpose of helping or injuring an institution, a cause, or a person. Ideas, facts, or allegations spread deliberately to further one's cause or to damage an opposing cause. Chiefly derogatory information, especially of a biased or misleading nature, used to promote or publicize a particular political cause or point of view. The dissemination of propaganda as a political strategy. Now, also, there's a secondary definition, which I don't think was meant in Ryan's email, and that is really where the term came from. If you see the word propaganda and it's capitalized, it is a congregation of the Roman Curia having jurisdiction over missionary territories and related institutions. Another way to put that, a committee of cardinals of the Roman Catholic Church responsible for foreign missions founded in 1622 by Pope Gregory 15. So propaganda, a term that we use to describe some sort of statement, some sort of idea that is inflated, that is misleading, that is by definition, at least in the Merriam-Webster's dictionary, false. So I'm interested.
Well, I don't know that I would agree with that. So Ryan said, and this is, you know, he, I think, inadvertently created a bit of a false choice. Mm-hmm. So propaganda is not necessarily false. And if you define it as just persuasive speech, then that's everything. And I agree. Yeah. But I think that I wouldn't say that propaganda is just persuasive or just false. I think that biased and misleading is a much better operational definition. It could be completely true, but the point is that you're presenting it in a way that is biased with a purpose. It's biased with a purpose of promoting or denigrating some agenda.
And it is at this point, it does have a pejorative connotation.
Yeah.
And I think that that's something that is important to point out. So just to further this a little bit, I wanted to get into the etymology. So then we can talk a little more about operational definitions and why they matter. So propaganda in 1718 was the direct translation of Congregatio de Propaganda Fide, which is the Congregation for Propagating the Faith. And that was that committee of cardinals that was established. Now, the Latin propagare is actually a movement to propagate some practice or ideology. So you can kind of see where that shift happened. And that was first coined in 1790. The modern political use of the term dates specifically from World War I. That's when it was first used. And it wasn't originally pejorative when it was first used. It just meant material or information propagated to advance a cause. So back in 1929, when we talked about propaganda, we were just talking about trying to advance a cause and disseminating information. And over time, as we see often happens, the meanings of words and their usages evolve with the culture. And now it does have a strong pejorative meaning. And I don't think you can really talk about propaganda without it having that, like you said, Steve, that kind of biased right. nature now.
Yeah.
It insinuates some level of deception.
Unfairness, nefariousness.
Or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or something behind the scenes that you can't immediately see.
Exactly. Right. And so I think it's a good word, but I do think it's important, as Ryan points out, that when we do argue, when we are, you know, engaging in that high level kind of rhetoric, to have operational definitions of words is so important, because when you get to the point where you're parsing speech and you're looking for fallacies and you're trying to build these sorts of assumptions, you have to know what the words you're using mean, and you have to ensure that the audience or the person you're arguing with knows what they mean as well. And some words mean so many things, or they have different shades of gray within them, that if you just define the term at the top, your argument won't generally devolve into semantic quibbles, which can get really frustrating.
And it's important to note that pseudoscientists and science deniers will deliberately use vague definitions of words in order to create deception, in order to mislead. Like, for example, creationists, you know, specifically intelligent design proponents, they will very deliberately misuse the word information. They won't define it specifically or operationally. They will just use it in a vague way, and they'll shift their definition as needed in order to evade arguments. You know, so this is a tactic of pseudoscientists to use vague or shifting definitions, which will enable them to squirm out of being backed into a corner. So that's why it's so important. And I guess we should define operational definition too. An operational definition just means that it's a way of defining something so that it's very specific. You know, like if you have A and B, then you have it. You know, then that's the definition. You can go through a process and determine very specifically if something fits the definition or not. So like there are very specific different operational definitions of information. You got to pick one and you got to use it, like mathematical definitions. But they're using it in this just a vague colloquial sense. And so they could shift around as needed. It's basically, you know, words are precise so that your thoughts can be precise. And when people use imprecise definitions, because their thinking is imprecise.
It's true. And I mean, it's something where I think the whole purpose of the segment, What's the Word, is there to try and describe the difference, because sometimes words do mean two different things in two different contexts. The perfect example is the word theory. And you see it all the time, again, with intelligent design advocates trying to use the word theory in a colloquial kind of societal sense when they're talking about the scientific definition, but they're utilizing the societal definition. And so it's really important that we know the difference between those things when they do exist.
And they're doing it for propaganda purposes.
It's true.
All right. Thanks, Kara.
Yep.
Let's move on to some news items. So there has been a change of government in Canada. I know the U.S. is in the midst of our campaign, which, don't get me started, is a travesty, but whatever. In Canada, the Harper administration has been replaced by the Trudeau administration. And one of the things that Trudeau has already reversed was Harper's policy of essentially restricting or censoring publicly or federally funded scientists from talking about their research, which was, you know, widely criticized policy. But what's interesting is that now that, you know, Harper is out of power, the scientists are in fact able to speak a little bit more freely about how bad it was. And it was a lot worse than I thought. You know, it really was oppressive. So Nature has a very in-depth report on it. We'll link to that. We're linking to my blog post about it, which has a link to the Nature article in it, as well as other backstory links. And it's a very in-depth report that interviews a number of scientists in Canada who were affected by this. And it is really stunning how oppressive the regulations were. So, you know, essentially the Harper administration said that, you know, federally funded scientists can't talk directly to the media about their research. So in practice, what that meant is, so previously, if a journalist needed a quote or needed a brief explanation or conversation with the scientist to write about a story, they'd call them up and they would talk to them. But with the new regulations, they would have to go through a bureaucrat, right? They would have to talk to a government official. And essentially, they would have to go through multiple layers of speaking to officials, to the point where they would never really get to anybody prior to their deadline. So, which is, I think, was by design. So what happened was, is that reporters essentially stopped even trying to make contact with the scientists. So they effectively cut off the press from federally funded scientists by putting in this onerous layer of bureaucratic red tape. But it's actually worse than that, because the scientists report that, like, for example, when they went to meetings, there literally would be a burly government agent babysitting them, making sure that they didn't talk out of turn, that they didn't talk about their research or say anything they weren't supposed to.
This is Gestapo. It's like, what the hell?
It's like the KGB. I mean, one of them said that, like, there were during the Soviet era, when Soviet scientists would visit, you know, and they had these, you know, humorless KGB agents shadowing them everywhere, that's exactly what it was like for them. That's what it reminded them of. It was just really oppressive.
Jeez.
It was horrible for morale. Everyone's morale was destroyed. They had totally cut them off from the media, and it was terrible. Now, you know, Harper justified this by saying that, well, sometimes these federally funded scientists, their research was involved lawsuits against the government or whatever, you know, that, so therefore we can't have them talking about research that might impact a court case. I don't know why this suddenly was a problem when it never apparently was a problem before.
Right.
But essentially what his critics said, well, the point of this was to protect industry, was to protect companies and to protect their ideology. So they didn't want, in one instance, researchers found that fish farming resulted in the propagation of viruses, which could then infect fish swimming in the ocean, you know, ocean populations. So that's a pretty significant environmental concern. You know, we have to be aware that this is a potential risk of fish farming so that we could do something about it. And they were prevented from talking about those findings to anybody because they didn't want to hurt the fish farming industry or whatever.
Oof.
So it was really, really, really horrible. And from reading the accounts, one other thing that struck me, obviously this is all terrible, is that all of the middlemen, right? All of the mid-position people in the government basically had to become complicit in all of this. So what's a bit disturbing is how quickly everyone fell into line with these Gestapo tactics.
They don't want to lose their jobs.
Well, I know that, but it's scary how quickly you can impose this kind of oppression onto a system. You know, you'd think that people wouldn't put up with it, but I'm not being judgmental. I mean, you can't judge people when you're not in their situation. You know, you have to put food on the table for your kids, et cetera, whatever. But it's, you know, this one administration was able to just clamp down on science communication, you know, and that was it. And everyone fell.
No whistleblowers.
No,
in all
everyone
this time.
Fell.
No activists.
There were people who quit in protest. You know, there were those people who did that. Absolutely.
Well, I don't know if they were loud enough in their protest because, you know,
this is an issue that goes far beyond Canada and beyond this one administration. Obviously, this can happen in many places, that essentially people in power want to control information because information is power, right? And scientific information is very powerful. And so people in power want to control it. They want the science to say what they want it to say, you know?
Steve, isn't it go like, I thought it was first you get the money, then you get the guns, and then you get the women, right?
Then you get the power. Then you get the women. That's right. So, yeah, but it's, you know, when the government, you know, obviously in a perfect ideal world, you know, you'd want the government to be informed by science and evidence, right? You'd have to, you know, you have to have complete hands off of the conduction of science. Scientists have to be free to do good quality, transparent science. And then that information, I think, belongs to the people, right? The people are funding it. You know, Harper's not paying for this research out of his own pocket. The public is funding this research. The research belongs to the public, in my opinion.
Come on, open it up.
Yeah.
Baby.
So then part of that, and I think in the US, research is funded by the government, you have to talk to the public about it. You know what I mean? That's like a requirement. Now, you have to include in your grant, how are you going to educate the people about the findings of your research that has been funded by them? You know, and that's great. We need to keep moving in that direction. We always, you know, you do have to be vigilant. It is amazing that, you know, every country, the U.S., Canada, everywhere, you have to be vigilant about democracy and transparency because it could be lost so quickly. You think of the, I mean, I think we have a fairly robust system, but I mean, just look at recent events.
And the consequences can be profound.
And it really is the stuff of like horror movies. It's the stuff of sci-fi. There's a reason that we see these themes over and over in our fiction.
Yeah.
Because it's so close to truth and it could so easily run that way. I just keep thinking about Orphan Black when you're talking about this. I just keep thinking about that's basically the main plot is that there's this huge conspiracy to cover this science that's happening. And we see that it can happen. Ugh, chills.
It's terrible. It just takes a little bit of complacency,
mm-hmm.
right? Or somebody who knows how to push the public's buttons. That's
is that code?
You know, yeah, I think we all know what I'm talking about.
It's amazing. Wink, wink, nod.
It is amazing. All right, anyway.
Oh, you trumped that one, Steve. Good job.
Jay, what the hell is biohacking?
That's a great question, Steve. I'm trying to find the answer to that question. So you guys have heard of hacking.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes,
now we have this phrase that's been kicking around for a while called biohacking. So put simply, trying to reduce this down to what I think it is, it's do-it-yourself biology in medicine, right? So individuals and small organizations and even some for-profit corporations engage in different kinds of biohacking to explore biology with the goal of, I guess, exploiting the human biology, right? And according to the internet, biohacking is when an individual manages in some way to enhance their own biology through the use of medical, nutritional, physical, or electronic methods. So I decided that I was just going to try to find some examples of what biohacking is to give us a better understanding. Here's a short list that I found. So one of them is taking a nootropic to improve focus, memory, and intelligence.
I think it's a nootropic.
That's close enough. Using a wearable fitness device like a Fitbit that records your biometric data. Okay, that's biohacking. Implanting magnets to detect electrical fields and pick up screws. I added the pick up screws part. which you could do, right?
It is helpful. It is helpful, for sure.
You know, you drop like that little screw with your eyeglass from your eyeglasses, and it's in the corner behind the furniture. Man, if my finger
get it, you'll never.
Yeah,
get
you need
that.
You need a magnetic finger, Evan.
See, but this is like slightly more advanced biohacking at this point than just like wearing a Fitbit.
No, you're right. Yeah, we're bouncing all over the place here. Last one, listen to this. Performing high-end gene sequencing research in a laboratory or in your garage. And I mean that in your garage statement. So part of the idea of biohacking is that you don't need to be a biologist to do it. And I'm not saying that everyone involved in biohacking is uneducated or lacking, you know, training or whatever. But there is this do-it-yourself garage laboratory vibe that's strongly associated with it. I think this is where the hacking aspect of it comes in. So people with no formal education are running experiments and some even use expensive equipment and they don't have training. So, you know, interpret that any way you will. There's a really interesting way to look at the entire concept, though. It's complete bullshit. I'm serious.
Yeah, I mean, I think, when I wrote about this recently, my take was that it doesn't even exist. Meaning, like, we just talked about definitions, right, Kara? So what is the operational definition of biohacking? Tell me what it is that isn't medicine and self-help.
But isn't biohacking not about maintaining or restoring, but improving? Isn't the idea that there's a baseline
and then
you're increasing?
And self-help.
And self-help. Gotcha.
And self-help. Because they talk about like drinking coffee. The caffeine's a stimulant. It makes sure it wakes up your brain. That's biohacking. Really? Coffee's biohacking? Is yoga biohacking? Is doing exercise weightlifting?
Under that definition, it would
be. Is weightlifting biohacking? Sure. Why not?
Is the iron I get from my food?
Yeah, it's just having good nutrition. It's, I think, in effect, it's just a new branding for
marketing.
It's a new marketing, new branding for self-help, specifically nutritional and, you know, snake oil type of nonsense.
And unregulated medicine. And
just what we don't
need. Yeah, because you could, because when you think about it, right? So I know what you're saying, Kara. You're like, yeah, we want to improve the capabilities of the human mind and body. Great. And I would argue that medicine is on that path. It's just on the slow, steady realistic path, right? They're trying to
That's health promotion.
Yeah.
Health promotion is part of medicine.
So I always thought that biohacking specifically required the use of technology. I guess I always made a distinction in my mind between like nootropics and like basically vitamins and like using tech.
That would be fine, Karen, if that were the definition.
Gotcha.
That's fine. And maybe some people think that is the definition and they use it that way, but it has evolved into just another self-help branding.
Yep.
And to equal, you know, like the butter coffee. Butter coffee, that's biohacking. No, it's just bullshit. That's what that is. But yeah, I think if if like cyborg kind of stuff where you're implanting electronics into your body, that's not, there's nothing unique or new to the concept of biohacking. But if you want to use that to refer to cyborg upgrades, fine. At least then it's a thing.
Yep.
At least then it's cool.
But it's being used now. It's just medicine and self-help and exercise and diet, and it's nothing new.
And woo. And a lot of woo.
And mostly bullshit. But,
Where can I buy this biohacking? But I find it very interesting when biohacking kind of crashes up against modern medicine, because again, Kara, I thought the same thing you did.
Yeah.
You know, it's about attaching a robotic arm to you so you could do all sorts of stuff. You know, but if you really like just take a 3-second breather and think about it, modern medicine is doing all of these things that biohacking has this aura of that it's about that, right? So as an example, the robotic arm. Real modern science does have robotic arms, and people are getting outfitted with them, where, you know, I don't see a bunch of self-named biohacking companies saying that, you know, we're doing this, but, you know, the typical modern medicine isn't, you know. They're not actually labeling themselves as biohacking companies. They're just companies that are making robotic arms for people that lost limbs, you know.
Yeah.
I thought this was funny, too. Would you consider something to be biohacking if it greatly improved your eyesight?
Like my glasses?
That's what I thought of. I'm like, well, there's eyeglasses that greatly improve my crappy 48-year-old eyesight.
That's true. Right? It is a hack. It's a way to hack my biology to make it more improved.
LASIK technology. eye surgery.
And eyeglasses are technology for sure. I mean, they're early technology, but they are by definition technology.
Yeah, so we're romancing it. We're thinking of like the sci-fi idea of this. You know, we can give you tons of examples of things that are in like the public consciousness about, oh yeah, we're gonna like the $6 million man gets, you know, these robotic legs or an eye implant or an ear, you know, hearing implants. Well, there was a company out there that makes these earbud type devices that you put in your ear and you leave them in your ear, and they allow you to change frequencies to, you know, raise or lower the overall volume of things you hear. That's if anything is biohacking, that's biohacking. Mm-hmm. But it's just a cyborg-like extension, right? It's not really connected to your body. It's something that, it's a device you use that gives you augmented capabilities.
Then by that definition, so is your iPhone.
Yeah, but that's, I know. So the thing is, when I said it's all bullshit, it really is kind of all bullshit. It's just not a good definition. It's not a clear thing. It's not really a movement so much as it is just a bunch of hype and sci-fi leftover. Now, if anyone disagrees or knows companies, yeah, write us in and let us know. But Steve and I did what I would consider to be a deep dive, and we really couldn't find anything legit.
And nootropics are just vitamins. They're just, usually when we think of vitamins, we think of somatic targets, not neural targets. But it's the same, like, shtick, right? If you take these vitamins or these supplements, X will happen in your brain. But that dates back forever, too. I mean, that's the same thing as fish oil and all these. There are a ton of vitamins that already exist like that, but now they're called nootropics, so they can charge more.
Or nutraceuticals.
But it's getting to it's getting to a point now. Like, again, this company, Bulletproof, like they're like saying they're extending people's lifespans with coffee. They're like, okay, use their diet plan to feed your mind and body. That's one thing that they say. They say to, eliminate toxins found in many crops. So they're essentially like anti.
What?
Always a red flag.
Anti like modern crop and GMO. They say that their diet keeps you in ketosis. And they said, this is great for your brain. What? I don't think that ketosis is great for your brain.
There are certain disorders where like a ketoacidosis can be helpful, but like I don't think that.
So this is not ketoacidosis. This is just ketosis. Without getting to the point where you're in a coma from ketoacidosis.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Again, there's just no evidence that this is in any long-term benefit. You know, they say, well, the brain, you know, likes to use ketones. No, the brain can use ketones. It prefers glucose, but it'll make do with ketones when it doesn't have glucose. That's just a survival mechanism. That's just so your brain doesn't shut down when you don't have enough sugar in your body. But they're turning
that's so you don't die.
Yeah, right. It's just, this is your rescue pathway. You know, this is what happens when you don't have enough sugar to feed your very hungry brain. But again, that's what I mean. Like they think they understand something about ketosis, but there's no clinical evidence to back up anything that they're saying.
Check
but
this out, Steve.
Sounds all sciencey, you know?
This was another one. This was the big one that just blew me away. Go gluten-free because gluten is bad for your health. And I'm quoting the website now. Gluten
just blank it.
Gluten causes your body to elevate levels of inflammation, particularly by forming, Steve, cytokines?
Cytokines.
Yeah. Cytokines. All right. So particularly by forming cytokines, proteins that are found in the patients with Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, and autism, all neurological diseases. So
wait, we all have those. That's just gluten. An inflammatory protein.
Exactly,
we all have cytokines.
Yeah. Red
cytokines.
Blood cells are also found in all of those diseases.
I know.
Too. Oh, my God.
A couple of other funny things, and then we can move on. So one thing they were saying is they consider like getting good sleep to be biohacking. That's their one of their big steps. Get good sleep.
Sleep. Right? Yeah.
And you know, eat well. That's like a biohacking advice.
Oh wait, I know what else is biohacking. Breathing.
Breathe. Oh, breathing, you should definitely breathe.
Breathing an earth-like atmosphere. Yeah.
And then they said hacking your nervous system by using meditation.
Mm-hmm. Relaxation. That's biohacking.
So anyway, yeah, have fun with biohacking out there, and we'll see you in about a decade.
I'm biohacking right now, in fact. Hey.
Learning, studying, and reading, that's all biohacking. Yeah. You're feeding your brain information.
Changing your mind.
Sure.
You're
talking.
You could change the physics in your mind, the cells in your mind, Steve, by reading.
Yeah. All right, Bob, I understand scientists have figured out everything we need to know about gravitational waves.
Well, I wouldn't go there at all. It seems like they may have found another associated wrinkle. Astronomers have announced a second potentially important discovery related to the gravitational wave announcement earlier this year. They spotted a burst of gamma rays near the area of the gravitational waves that may have been caused by a short gamma ray burst. Now, such simultaneous events could together reveal details that would otherwise have been totally hidden from view. So, of course, I've got to go over the gravitational wave thing really quick. I'm sure you all remember it. Probably one of the biggest scientific discovery of the year. LIGO announced they detected gravitational waves from what appears to be two black holes that merged. Each black hole was massive, 30 solar masses each approximately. And this was the first time we've had such solid evidence for the detection of gravitational waves. And it could, of course, open an entirely new field, gravitational wave astronomy. So huge, huge news. So it turns out, though, that less than a half a second after that event occurred in September of 2015, the Fermi Gamma Ray Burst Monitor, GBM, got hit with a faint pulse of high-energy X-rays that lasted only about a second.
Yeah, that's a coincidence.
It's the
microwave.
It certainly could be, but some estimates put that the odds that it was a coincidence at far less than 1%. Now, Fermi's GBM, you might not be familiar with it. It essentially scans the entire sky that's not blocked by the Earth for X-rays and gamma rays. And typically, it's looking for energies between 8,000 and 40 million electron volts, which is a lot. If you consider visible light ranges from 2 to 3 electron volts, this is some energetic stuff. And of course, gamma rays doesn't get much more energetic than that. So the GBM is the best current instrument for detecting gamma ray bursts. These are the brightest electromagnetic events known in the entire universe. Certain supernovae and hypernovae release much of their energy in a collimated beam of death that comes out of both poles. And GRBs, gamma ray bursts, are so intense they can wreak havoc from thousands of light years away. I read of some estimates from a burst from 8,000 light years away. It could potentially deplete 20 to 70% of the ozone. It would then, of course, raise UV levels. It could chemically damage the stratosphere and collapse food chains. So, and in fact, some mass extinctions point to a gamma ray burst as the cause. So they can be very nasty, and that's even if they're still far away. Fortunately, Fermi, or maybe unfortunately, Fermi did not see a regular gamma ray burst. They can last for a few minutes to even hours. This one lasted only a second. So this is a subset of a gamma ray burst. It's called a short gamma ray burst, kind of like I'm a subset of novella called short novella. You know? Best analogy I can come up with. So it's believed a different process creates the short GRBs, such as a collapsing neutron star or black hole, which of course would create these titanic gravitational waves, which we've detected. Now, the main mystery, though, is that the black hole mergers aren't supposed to emit a boatload of X-rays or gamma rays. It just, the theory just does not account for that. For that to happen, you'd expect to have some gas orbiting around it to create it. But any gas that's around a binary black hole would be consumed by the black holes before the merger. So it's a little puzzling. And for that reason, some scientists believe that the gamma ray detection was just a coincidence and had nothing to do with the gravitational wave generating collision. But some theories, though, attempt to explain how they could be generated. But we definitely need more observations to really pin down what happens when two such objects merge. Hopefully we'll catch a glimpse of the gravitational waves of another black hole merger in the near future. So, like I said, the chance of coincidence is very low, just like 0.2%, I believe. And I've heard some figures even far less than that. The gamma rays, though they were potentially very helpful. They helped us pinpoint exactly where in the sky the gravitational waves came from. So imagine LIGO identified a swath of the sky 600 degrees wide where the gravitational waves could have come from. And that was a little bit of a surprise. I thought it was pinpointed better than that, but 600 degrees is kind of big. Fermi identified an overlapping swath where the gamma rays could have come from. So where those two areas overlap, that's the most likely location of the event. And it actually reduced the possibility from 600 degrees of the sky down to 200. So that was really, really helpful in pinpointing where this whole thing came from. Lindy Blackburn, she's a postdoctoral fellow at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. She said, there's an incredible synergy between the two observations, with gamma rays revealing details about the source's energetics and local environment, and gravitational waves providing a unique probe of the dynamics leading up to the event. So we potentially found a gamma ray partner to some type of gravitational waves that could together solve even more mysteries. So let's just hope we see those black hole mergers again real soon. So cool stuff.
Yeah.
Gamma ray bursts. They are scary, man. They are scary.
Yeah, that's true.
Imagine it's basically a beam of death from like a Death Star. I mean, it's this thing. Can you imagine?
Negative.
It's like a laser beam that could fry your planet from light years away. It's just amazing power.
Mm-hmm. Bob, if it did that to the ozone, would we know, like, would we hear a noise, you think? Or, you know, what would happen?
A noise? It's an interesting question. I think I could say that the sky would look all freaky for a little while, and we'd be saying, what the hell is happening?
Freaky how?
Why is my skin burning?
I'm not sure. I've never seen or read any simulations.
Would there be aurora all over the place?
Ooh, that'd be awesome.
You're chemically changing the stratosphere. Nothing would really surprise me, but I'm just not sure if there'd be any visible effects that we would see. But
would we just have instant cancer?
No.
Kara, did you see Raiders of the Lost Ark?
Yes.
Remember at the end where he says, it's beautiful, and his face melts off. His head blew up.
Is that what the other guy's
face melted off. That's what it would be like. Yeah.
It's beautiful. Bleh.
Opening of the ark.
All right, Kara, this is an interesting news item. I had some problems with the reporting, which is not uncommon, but tell me about slime molds.
Yes, I am really into this news item because
me too.
I always Yeah, I always knew that slime molds were awesome, but I never knew quite how awesome they were and also how complicated slime molds are. So the news item is that some researchers in Paris actually did some experiments on a specific type of slime mold and were able to show that it habituates to irrelevant stimuli. And so they are presenting this as a type of learning, which actually in kind of the psychological literature, yeah, that is a very specific type of learning, and it's a common thing that we look at in infants to see if they are, if they're cognitively kind of like where they need to be. So, a little bit of backstory, they specifically wanted to focus on a type of slime mold called Physarum polycephalum, which literally translates to the many-headed slime, which I love.
Awesome.
Yeah. So slime molds come in a ton of different types. I think there's something like 900 known species of slime mold.
Flavors.
And yeah, the weird thing about slime mold is, A, it's not a fungus. It's right. Like, it's not really what we think of as traditional mold. And B, all the different types of slime mold aren't even that similar species-wise. Like, they come from different classes, different orders, different families. So this one specifically that we're talking about, Physarum polycephalum, is a slime mold that is an amoebozoid slime mold. So Ooh. It is a single cellular organism.
Yeah, they are fascinating. They are protists.
Yeah, they're protists. Yeah.
Which basically means we're not sure what this is. Let's throw it into this category.
Yeah, it's like we used to think that protists were like animals, and that, you know, protists have changed their classification multiple times over the years of taxonomy because, yeah, they're sort of like the catch-all classification. But we know of protists from learning about amoebas and paramecium in school. You guys remember learning about them, right? And seeing them under the microscope. Paramecium brain. What movie is that from? See, this is for a different generation listening. Paramecium brain.
Oh, you got me on that one.
I think it's from Sandlot.
Didn't see
Which was
it.
Such a movie when I was a kid. Yay, Sandlot. Anyway, some people listening will appreciate that. So Physarum polycephalum, which is the big yellow slime mold that you'll often see in like your garden, not often, but sometimes you might see it in your garden that sort of splays out in a bunch of different directions. It's fascinating. It's only one cell, but it has a lot of nuclei if it's already gone through its sort of mating cycle of its life. So it can be multinucleated, single cell. And of course, it has no brain. It also doesn't even have what we think of as like a rudimentary brain like many insects do, which we would call a ganglion, which is like a little cluster of nerve cells that sort of function like a very, very premature brain. It doesn't have either of those things. But historically, they have been shown to be able to solve mazes. They follow efficiency paths, for example. It's been shown that they will choose the most efficient or the most nutritive food source over a lesser nutritive food source. These are all things that we think of as having great evolutionary advantage. The question is, how are they doing it? So the study at hand right now was just published in Proceedings of the Royal Society B. And what the researchers at this university in Paris did is they said, we want to look at the mechanism of habituation, which is a very, I guess, simple type of learning if you want to define it as learning. It's having a diminishing response to a stimulus that's not relevant. So think about, I don't know, a baby, and you're going to show the baby something that you want him to pay attention to, but then the baby hears something that catches his attention and he looks at it. After a while, if that thing in the background continues to happen, he's going to have a habituated response and he's no longer going to look at it. And that's how researchers can study, oh, this baby is learning. He's learning that when the refrigerator makes noise, nothing happens. He doesn't get food. He doesn't get mommy. It's just a noise the refrigerator makes and he's no longer paying close attention to it. And it's a really necessary part of getting by. And so they decided, I don't know if that was a good example.
One of the examples they gave was like,
you have
a new puppy. Yeah. And then
maybe that one's better.
Every time a car goes by, then it eventually realizes that nothing bad's going to happen. So it stops barking.
Unless you have a dog like my dog, who is like special, and he just barks every time a car goes by regardless.
Yes, as does Molly. There is no habituation going on at all.
None whatsoever. But it's, you know, think about all the times in your life when habituation really mattered. Like think about how you can't feel your shoes. You wear shoes every day. Can you imagine if you could constantly feel your shoes on your feet? That would not be good. You just get used to certain things and you don't pay attention to them anymore.
Yeah, that's so important. It's basically your skin is there to tell you, this is what's new. If it's not new, yes. You become habituated to it.
Exactly. And so I keep using the infant example because this is the type of research that's often done with infants, because infants can't talk, neither can slime molds. So what they did is they chose to use two chemicals, quinine and caffeine, which are actually harmless to slime molds, but they're bitter. So they're off-putting, even though they actually aren't dangerous. And they built this little bridge. They put the slime mold in agar and they built a little bridge to have the slime mold in one petri dish full of agar and the food source in another petri dish full of agar. And they treated the bridge with two chemicals. In some instances, they used quinine. In other instances, they used caffeine. Now, neither of those chemicals is harmful to the slime mold, but they're both off-putting because they're bitter. And so they wanted to know, A, will these slime molds cross the bridge in order to get to the food? And then once they realize that the food is there, that they're not going to be injured by this, will they do it faster? And what they found was that when compared to a matched control, they took significantly longer to get across the bridge. So the slime molds who had to go to either the caffeine or the quinine, or had to go across the caffeine or the quinine to get to the food, took 200 minutes on early attempts. And that was over three times the amount of time that it took the slime molds that didn't have to deal with caffeine or quinine. But then they realized that by day six, once they had, quote, habituated or learned that the quinine or the caffeine wasn't dangerous, they were able to move over in a less cautious way, in a way that was less specific and also significantly faster. Now, they wanted to make sure that this wasn't some sort of effect of just exhaustion, right? Like, I've been doing this so long, I now know this is a more efficient path, I don't want to deal with it anymore. You know, that it wasn't about habituating to the chemical, but just that they were getting tired. So they did something pretty smart. They switched it up. The ones that were trained on quinine, they now gave caffeine and vice versa. And what they found was they just reverted instantly back to their timid way, that slow, very specific way of crossing the bridge. And then they again rehabituated and were able to do it more quickly. So it's nice that they had these multiple types of controls worked into this experiment. I think it's actually quite a brilliant and what we often say in science, elegant experiment, meaning that it's just very simple. So the researchers are saying, you know, I consider this to be learning in a very classical psychological sense. We think about classical conditioning. We think about operant conditioning. We think about habituation, these very simple types of learning. And we've done these experiments in animals, even in plants, even in protista over the years. This is a very specific type of learning. Granted, it's not high level. Granted, it obviously doesn't require a brain or even a ganglion. This is a single-celled organism, yet it is capable of habituation. So, you know, maybe we should be rethinking how we define learning, maybe even how we define intelligence. I don't think that this has any sort of great meaning with regards to how we as human beings learn, but more I think it has evolutionary insights.
So just to play devil's advocate a little bit, I thought that the reporting, not in the paper itself, but in like the press release, was a little bit heavy-handed with the whole learning bit.
Oh, completely.
Yeah, so it's like, yeah, if you broaden the definition of learning to, you know, this kind of behavior. And when you know, the thing is, it's not learning in the sense that a nervous system learns and that it's storing information. There's just a very simple chemical algorithm in there. You know, it's like it's chemotaxis, right?
It is chemotaxis.
You go up or down the chemical gradient. It affects some behavior in some way, like bacteria. They swim and spin, you know, and the ratio of swimming and spinning changes depending on whether or not they're going up a gradient of something they like or down a gradient of something they don't like, whatever. It's just basically chemotaxis.
Yeah, and the interesting thing here is that it's chemotaxis with habituation component.
Sure, so you're down-regulating those receptors. You know, it could be something as simple as that. Is down-regulating, meaning receptor gets less responsive if you keep hitting it over and over again. Does that...
Yeah, so it's almost more like addiction than it is learning,
yeah,
right?
Is that really learning? Is receptor habituation learning. So they're broadening the definition to include this. Then they're saying that it changes our understanding of learning. No, it just changed your definition of the word learning. You know, whatever. I just thought it was.
I think what
cheesy.
It really does more than anything is that it helps us again sometimes when we stop and we take a look at the micro world, and actually in this case, slime molds are macro. That's why they're so fascinating. They're these single cellular organisms that are freaking huge.
They're the blob.
But when you, they're the blob, yeah. But when you stop and you look at things that we think of as being fundamentally simple, they're often more complex than we give them credit for.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think you're absolutely correct. And that's kind of what I found annoying is not, it's that they missed the real story here. You know, they framed it in as kind of a simplistic way that doesn't really, I think, teach the person who's reading it what's actually going on. It's not that, oh, it turns out you don't need a brain to learn. I mean, that's not the lesson here. The lesson here is that seemingly simple organisms can display very complex behavior, that there are other mechanisms for complexity other than advanced brains. You know, they could be chemically very complicated, and that could, you know, be a basis for behavior that we think of as being very complicated. That's, I think, really the lesson there.
And that's what, yeah, you're right. And that's what, when I read this article, I was like, oh, I love it. This is so fascinating. It's such a fascinating species. I feel like if the reporter had set up, you know, slime molds and specifically Physarum polycephalum better, you would have been like, whoa, it's so cool. I want to learn everything there is to know about it.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
That's not the world we live in.
I know.
All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Okay, guys, I played this noisy last week. So that one, oh, don't forget the ending, because that was the big clue. That one tweaked something with Steve. Steve, you had a little disturbance
in
the force.
It's a telephone thing that is my sort of memory is that if something happens. Like if
it's like a dial-up-y thing.
Yeah, you know, if you call.
Like early internet thing, right?
No.
Is it a payphone?
If you dial a phone that's out of service or something, I don't know, some kind of message that you get over the phone. That's what it reminded me of.
Anybody else?
Yeah, well, some
a fax
some
machine? No, that's not what it sounds like when you call a fax, is
it? Something having to do with the telephone. Ahoy, hoy.
Ahoy, hoy.
All right, so here is what it is. It's having to do with telecommunications.
Yes.
In-band singling. It's the sending of metadata and control information within the same band or channel used for voice. So this was actually something that gets played at the end of a TV station doing their daily transmission.
Oh, yeah.
No way.
Yes.
That's awesome. Wow.
I thought they usually just play the national anthem and go to bed.
But that's not the case anymore, right? Because most TV stations, or you have to do a digital broadcast now.
Yeah, they're called DTMF tones, and yeah, they're not being used anymore. They might still send like this call sign to say, hey, we're shutting off now or whatever. But you don't hear it. This was like, you know, back in, I think it ended in the 90s or was developed in the 90s and ended in the, you know, the aughts. So there's telephone and then non-telephone. So this one here was definitely non-telephone. DTMF tones. They're also used by cable television broadcasters to indicate the start and stop times of local insertion points during station breaks.
Okay.
So very
it's
cool.
It's a queuing mechanism. It's like our sync that we do in a way.
So the winner, Andrew Hansford, he said DTMF tones used for in-band signaling. Awesome, Andrew. I don't know how you do that. My guess
is he works for...
he works in broadcast.
Yeah, he works at Optimum or something.
Because of that weird phone sound that it came, you know, the familiar phone sound, a lot of people said that these are coins going into a payphone, which, you know, isn't that far off because it is the phone, that physical phone telling the phone company this money has been dropped. So, very good, guys. Good. You got a ton of responses, by the way. A lot of people making cool guesses. So, this week's noisy. Check this out. Weird,
whoa,
huh?
That's weird.
Now,
so
I
the afterlife does exist.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it's ghosts.
This was sent in by a listener named Eric Barsick, and Boy, is this interesting. Boy, is this interesting. Pretty much everybody will be able to relate to this because of how everyone has used something that has to do with this. How about that? Very interesting, noisy. I know. It's really cool. Like, I did a deep dive on it, and I'm, like, blown away that I didn't hear about it before, and then just how creepy it sounds. It's super ethereal. Email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org with your guesses and with your awesome noisies. Keep sending them to me, guys. You're sending me a lot of cool stuff, and I'm building up a catalog. You know what? Good luck. This one's a hard one.
All right. Thanks. Thank you, Jay. That was cool. So, Jay, we're a week out from Nexus, and we have a couple of shows that I want to talk about that are attached to Nexus. If only George were here to talk about them with us.
Bam.
Is that you, George?
Hello.
Weird.
How did that
Lady
happen?
Person with the skepticking.
You're the skeptic that fell to earth.
George, awesome. How you doing,
That's
buddy?
Me.
What's up, George?
Wow, this internet's amazing, isn't it? I think it's going to catch on. I really think it's going to catch on. I don't care what you think, Jay. I think this internet is here to stay for a while. Wow. Are you guys ready? Are you ready for Nexus? Are you guys ready for Nexus? Can you even
Absolutely.
Stand that
oh,
this is so
gosh.
Close to being a thing?
I'm never ready until it's it. Happening.
I'm kind right. of freaking out, you guys. This is my first Nexus.
Oh, my
Your
gosh.
First?
That's right.
Ooh. Yeah.
First timer.
We're gonna
You'll never be the same.
I'm freaking out because Kara is doing the Skeptical Extravaganza with us. I can't wait. Kara, so you're going to love it.
Awesome.
What night is that, Jay, the Skeptical Extravaganza? Isn't that what day of the week is that happening? And what's,
that's
what's
Friday the 13th.
Oh, that's right.
Awesome.
The 13th.
My
perfect.
Favorite day.
We're doing the whole show under a ladder. It's going to be perfect.
Kara, it is as haunted as the most haunted place on the earth.
Oh,
no place is more haunted.
I love this show because we can change it up. You know, like this isn't like a format that we have to follow. Like we just come up with new bits that we want to do. And this year we came up with some really new and awesome stuff. I can't wait. You'll see. If you go to the show, you'll see what we got going on.
Is there a special guest which is going to be at that show as well? I forget. Is there?
Yeah, Bill Nye.
Right. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, he had so much fun last year that he specifically requested that he join us again this year for the extravaganza. Even if you're not attending the entire Nexus conference, you can buy tickets just for the extravaganza on Friday night. Of course, if you are coming to the conference, why wouldn't you go to the extravaganza? It's going to be awesome. And George, also, you're doing a thing on Thursday night. Tell us about that.
Thursday night. I'm really excited. This is a piece that I'm performing Thursday night to kind of kick off the entire weekend. It's called The Broad Street Score. And this is 20 years worth of music, 20 years worth of my music, which has been reorchestrated for string quartet and voice. I premiered the piece here in Bethlehem back in January in the middle of a 3.5-foot snowstorm. So I had a very small but loyal audience. So I'm kind of counting this as the premiere. It's the New York City premiere, but in many ways, this is the premiere of the Broad Street Score. My incredibly good friend, Slough Hallatin, he orchestrated half the pieces, and a gentleman that I literally met on Twitter from Finland named Veiko Rihu, he orchestrated the other half. Veiko's going to be in the States. He's coming to the conference, which is very exciting. We're going to premiere this piece sort of officially in New York City. It's amongst the musical adventures that I've had, I'm probably most proud of this piece because it's the most sort of a piece. It's really fun. It's got this scientific skeptical mindset to it because it's 20 years worth of me sitting here in Bethlehem writing songs about skepticism and science and falling in love and falling out of love and going on adventures and doing all kinds of stuff. And it's a nice arc. There's kind of a story to it. And on top of it all, just as if that wasn't enough, the incredibly talented Haiting Chin is going to be our narrator because there's a narration that goes along with this as well.
Awesome.
So I figured if we're going to have one of the premier opera singers in the world, why make her sing? I'm just going to have her be the narrator.
I'm sure she appreciates that.
Good call, George.
I'm not going to be nervous enough singing, so I figured let me have, again, one of the premier opera singers in the world sort of there on stage to just kind of be, just to add to my overall kind of nervousness, but just to enhance the thing. So, no, I'm really excited. If you are in New York City Thursday night, May 12th, again, you don't have to be a Nexus registrant to come to the show. It's going to be a really, if you're into into classical music, if you're into strings, if you're into weird sort of different things, reorchestrations, if you've ever heard Elvis Costello's album, The Juliet Letters,
yes,
that was awesome. Kind of the inspiration for this. I mean, that album is an incredible record, and that thing is 25 years old, so I thought, okay, it's time for someone else to do something similar to that, and that's what we've done. So I'm really excited. I'm really, really, really excited for this. I think it's going to be a very special, different kind of night, and it's going to kick off Nexus, and you come do that, and then you come to the extravaganza on the next night, and then you can come see Baba Brinkman on the third night, which is going to be its own fantastic thing as well.
George, do you play as part of the Broad Street score? Do you do When I Was Your Age?
That song is included, yes. I know that's a favorite of yours. Yeah, that's it's 13 songs are in there.
Is it, and, do you also play the one that always makes everybody cry?
I do.
Oh,
I do.
Yeah.
And
damn it.
And let me tell you.
Bring your tissues.
The arrangement with the strings, you thought you cried before.
Oh boy.
This Slough did that arrangement, and it's like Indiana Jones pulling out the heart on the bridge. I mean, it's beautiful.
That's the second Indiana Jones reference this episode.
That's true.
Really? Wow. Ooh, really?
What are the odds? Okay.
Goodbye, Dr. Jones.
We'll all be there too. So if you do come, we're going to be hanging out before and after the show. So feel free to come up and, of course, say hi, talk to us. That's why we're there. But I'm George, totally dying to see this show, man. I just can't wait to see it. I've been a fan of your music since I've known you, and I have your songs, totally memorized. So it's going to be an awesome experience for me because I'm going to be, experiencing this reorchestration of all that stuff. But I'll be able to sing along.
We've been saying it's kind of you get to hear them. You get to hear your favorite songs for the first time.
George, I can't wait. So we will see you next Thursday in New York City.
Yes, yes, yes.
And if you want to come see us, see George, see the extravaganza, go to necss.org, and you can sign up for anything you want.
Yeah. Yay.
All right.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, George. See you then.
Thanks, buddy.
Ciao, brother.
See you, George.
All right. Well, we're going to do one email this week. We got a lot of emails about this. This has been in the news quite a bit, and everyone was interested to hear us talk about it. This question comes from Trevor from Taiwan, Canada. I didn't realize there was a Taiwan, Canada.
Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah, it's Taiwan / Canada. So,
oh, maybe he's from
travels
from
back and forth.
Dual citizen, maybe.
So he says, I came across this story this evening while reading CBC. I guess that's the
Canadian Broadcasting Company.
Yep. A discussion on this might be interesting on multiple levels. If there is a scientifically supported link between this product, that's Johnson & Johnson baby talcum powder, and cancer, then the lawsuit is arguably justifiable. If there is not, then this is pandering to the natural fallacy in that the jurors are responding to big company give innocent people cancer. And then he says you have to read that in a stereotypical caveman voice for full effect. However, if the talcum powder does have a proven link to cancer, wait, how could it? It's natural, isn't it? The natural fallacy gets turned on its head. I'm not saying I know either way. I'm just reading a lot of reports that say talcum powder gives cancer, 12,000 more lawsuits pending. Thanks for the question, Trevor. Basically, the reason we're getting so many questions about this is because a jury came back deciding a lawsuit against Johnson & Johnson, awarding a woman who developed ovarian cancer $55 million on the idea that talcum powder caused her ovarian cancer. This is also the second recent major judgment. Earlier in the year, in February, there was another case where a jury found for the plaintiff and awarded them $72 million. So that's two big judgments against Johnson & Johnson. I wrote about it at the time, read all the studies published on the association between talcum powder and cancer. So here is what the data shows. Then we could talk about whether or not we think these judgments were appropriate or not. Talcum powder originally, this is going back a long time ago, contained asbestos. And asbestos does cause cancer. But since the 1970s, talc has been asbestos-free. So yes, there is a link between asbestos and cancer, but that was removed from talc by the 1970s. So now the question is, does the asbestos-free talc have any association with cancer? And as is often the case, the evidence is mixed and ambiguous. There was a 2003 meta-analysis involving 11,933 subjects, and they found that there was a 33% relative risk increase of ovarian cancer for regular genital talc users. Essentially, if you use talcum powder but not on your genitals, there's no association with cancer. So the only question is, for like women who regularly apply it to their genitals, does that cause or increase your risk of ovarian cancer? So this meta-analysis showed a 33% increase for it's like you have to do it on a regular basis for years, which is not uncommon. People do, like, every time they take a shower, they talc up afterwards, right? So that's actually how it's used. So they found a 33% relative risk. Remember, relative risk is not absolute risk. It doesn't mean you have a 33% chance of getting cancer. The baseline risk of ovarian cancer is 0.0121% per year. So therefore, a 33% increased risk is an increased absolute risk of getting ovarian cancer of 0.004%, which means that, assuming that association is real, that translates to 4 extra cases of ovarian cancer for every 1 million people who regularly use talcum powder on their genitals.
In the world of cancer, is that considered very significant?
That's significant. Background noise. It's so tiny, it's hard to know if it's real or not.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the authors concluded that while this was a statistical association, there was no dose response curve, meaning that the risk did not increase with increasing time of exposure. Like, how many years were you doing this? That's a big red flag that it's not real, because mm-hmm. real risk factors like that generally have a dose response curve. It doesn't prove it's not real, but it's a huge red flag.
Well, what does it have a dose response curve?
Yeah, I mean, that's like one of the things. It's like, you look for that to know if it's real. And if there's no dose response curve, generally you consider it not to be real. So there have been other studies as well. There was a large 2013 case control study looking at 8,525 cases, 9,859 controls. They did find a 24%, again, relative risk increase, but again, no dose response. And then there was a small 2015 study looking at 2,041 cases with epithelial ovarian cancer and 2,100 age and residence match controls, and found a 33% increase, relative risk increase, but also no dose response, although they did find a quote-unquote trend. But a trend is the term that researchers use when there isn't a statistically significant difference, right? So yes, it was increased, but it didn't reach statistically significant. It didn't reach statistical significance, which in my book always means it's not real. You can't make any statements about that. If it's not even statistical significance is like the minimum bar for saying, yeah, this is not just, random fluctuation. Again, doesn't mean it's not real. It just means the evidence really doesn't support that it is. So that's it. That's the evidence for regular users of talcum powder on the genitals, women specifically. There is this pretty consistent increased association in the literature, but not a dose response curve. And in absolute numbers, it's so tiny that it's hard to know if it's real or not, because, even subtle confounding factors could be responsible here. Remember, this is all observational data, or most of it anyway. And for example, for these kinds of studies, all it would take is a little bit of recall bias to explain these effects. Now, recall bias means that if you are a woman and you do come down with ovarian cancer, you may have a tendency to report more talcum powder use than if you didn't come down with ovarian cancer. Does that make sense? Because the big studies, with lots of patients are just asking women, tell us about your talcum powder use, so it's based on memory. And that whenever any studies are based on that kind of data, there's recall bias is a potential there. And when you get these tiny effects, again, especially without that confirming sort of pattern of a clear dose response curve, it's controversial. Now, of course, that's why Johnson & Johnson says the science has not shown that there's a cause and effect here. It certainly hasn't been proven, but there's not like smoking. Smoking causes lung cancer, right? I mean, the data is pretty much a home run for that kind of data, and the tobacco industry just denied it. But This is totally different. This really is, if you're just looking at this in a purely scientific point of view, like just looking at the numbers, these numbers are not compelling. It certainly, you can't rule out that there is a correlation, a real correlation, but it's ambiguous at best. So where does that leave us? So should these juries have given, the first woman $72 million and the second woman $55 million based upon this data? That's a very interesting question. What do you guys think about that?
Steve, to me, this is a no-brainer. I mean, the research has not reached statistical significance. Game over. Bottom line. I mean, 4 in a million. I mean, it looks just like noise. So you can't. This would be a hell of a precedent.
Yeah. It's true, but I understand where Steve's coming from when he says, just because the science hasn't proven it yet. Because a lot of times when we do talk about these types of big industry links, I mean, a great example is, I always recommend read Tom's River by Dan Fagan. It's a story of like systematic poisoning of the groundwater in Tom's River, New Jersey from this dye factory that just was untouchable. Nobody could get near it. Nobody could do proper testing. They only used their own scientists. They had such an army of lawyers. And a lot of times, uncomfortably or unfortunately, legislation is written in such a way that the consumer, the torts aren't powerful. Like the consumer doesn't have the power, it's the company.
Yeah, so I agree. Yeah, I do think that that's what people respond to this as, like, well, companies have all the money, they have all the power. Mm-hmm. So in this situation, we're going to favor, the plaintiff because this is their only way, of getting justice from a big, powerful company.
But it's the worst example. Yeah, that's the problem. Right, this is not the example.
This is a very low probability maybe, and you're going to award millions of dollars on that?
They did.
That's bullshit.
The other way to look at this is that did the company do anything wrong? Meaning, did they hide research?
Right. Yes, right. Mm-hmm. Did they suppress information?
Exactly. Or is this just that they, in good faith, they tested their product, the FDA approved it, everyone in good faith thought that it was completely safe. It turns out there's this tiny risk that didn't emerge until decades later. The thing is, the juries awarded these sums of money as with punitive damages. They wanted to punish the company.
As if there was intent or deception.
Yeah. I haven't heard, maybe something came out in trial that we haven't heard that made them feel that way, but the sense I'm getting from reading the accounts of this is just that, no, they just feel sorry for the person who had cancer, rightfully so, and big anonymous companies are just easy villains. And, I think, in fact, I would argue, and I have argued, I don't think juries should be deciding these cases. These are very technical science-based cases, and I don't know. I think that they often turn on emotion.
Yeah,
I don't know
exactly
that justice is best served. Yeah, mm-hmm. By that. I don't know.
It's a tough situation.
It's a tough situation, yeah.
You don't want to crumble the justice system, but I do wish that there were better mechanisms in place in a courtroom where, like, somehow scientific evidence was weighted more heavily than, like, eyewitness testimony.
Maybe we need something along the lines of a special set of appeals courts that is more.
Well, they are going to appeal. They're going to appeal.
But that, yeah, like the science-based appeals court where it's right. Just stacked with experts. Like, that would be interesting.
All right, guys. Well, let's go on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. You guys ready?
Yes, ready as I was last week.
Ready to rebound from last week's sweep. I have to get like a file that has a sound of like a sweeping noise.
Sound You're really going to bring up last week?
Okay, here we go. Item number 1. Following up on prior predictions, astronomers report that direct observations support the existence of a distant 9th planet in our solar system. Item number 2, in a recent study, every security software product tested actually lowered the level of security from the level already provided by browsers and operating systems. And Item number three, scientists find that subjective feelings of confidence may be rooted in unconscious, rigorous statistical analysis. Kara, go first.
Ugh, okay. oh, God. Following up on prior predictions, astronomers report that direct observations support the existence of a distant ninth planet in our solar system. Yeah, so we know about planet. Well, it's actually planet X, but it would be the ninth since we ousted Pluto. Direct observations. Yeah, didn't we already directly observe it?
That was a mathematical inference.
Shit. Okay, I'm going to move on. In a recent study, every security software product tested actually lowered the level of security from the level already provided by browsers and operating systems. I really want this one to be science because that's hilarious. And then scientists find that subjective feelings of confidence may be rooted in unconscious, rigorous statistical analysis. That one's cool. I'm going to say that the psychology study is science. I'm hoping that it is the case that when we have feelings, like what we call instincts, that really human quote-unquote instincts really are just an amalgamation of a lot of other experiences, and that we have some sort of algorithm to test whether or not we should be more or less confident about something. So I'm going to say that one is the science. The obvious one would be that the Planet X is science and security software is the fiction. So I'm going to say the opposite. I'm going to say that it is science that every security product actually lowered the level of security, only because that would be awesome. And especially because I'm a Mac user and I'm a total snob about it. And I'm going to say that it's the fiction that we have any direct observations to support this planet, that we're still just understanding it in a mathematical sense.
Okay, Jay.
Okay, so interesting, Kara. Hmm. Interesting that you're a Mac user that hates non-Mac users.
I don't hate non-Mac
users.
She's
a Mac bigot.
Yeah, you are.
It sounds like a new sandwich at McDonald's.
Terrible.
I think this one's the fiction. I think that operating systems and browsers are not providing more security than security software. Because, now here's the problem. The term security software is so unbelievably broad.
Yeah, it's true. Saying
every security software product, what? I mean, there's even different kinds, you know, we can't, it just seems very loose to me. So that one's the fiction. I believe the other two were definitely not the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Well, I'm going to say start from the bottom, the subjective feelings of confidence, rigorous statistical. I know people are not, don't have an intuitive sense of statistics, but in some sense, I think you could say that, you know, people do, you know, weigh certain options and think about things in a way that could give them some leg up statistically. So that one doesn't sound as problematic as these other guys. The security software one. I mean, I could see that the word that's getting me here is everyone. I could see some of them making your computer less secure because some of them actually, you know, they take over some of the control. They actually lower the security setting. And that, I think that might be one way that it could be less safe. So that doesn't surprise me, but everyone, and the first one there about direct observation of the ninth planet, how the hell would I miss that? They said that would take years. I mean, there's a lot of space out there. I mean, I think they did kind of determine what area of space, but I mean, it's a tiny, you know, non-luminous object. It's not going to be easy to find, and this was only announced a little while ago. All right, I'm going to say the security one. I heavily doubt every security software product that they tested decreased it. So I'll say that's fiction.
Okay, and Evan.
Bob, what if they only tested 4 security products?
bad test then.
Right, but we don't know. You know, we don't know. Thousands,
we
hundreds,
will.
Two? Right, which leads, Bob, I think your point about the direct observation of the ninth planet is your first thought was my first thought. Why the hell didn't I hear about that? Anytime I see planet, exoplanet, I tend to be not up on everything, but you know, when it comes to our solar system, I do try to pay special close attention. I think I would have seen it. I'm going with that one as the fiction. I'm with Kara.
Okay. Whoa. So it's Bob and Jay with the security software. And Evan and Kara with the planet. Is that right, Jay?
Yes, and so we're split down the middle, and we're going head to head tonight, guys.
Okay, oh, but we'll start with the third one since you all agree on that one.
Confidence.
Scientists find that subjective feelings of confidence may be rooted in an unconscious, rigorous statistical analysis. You all think that one is science. Are you all confident?
I'm so happy.
Statistical analysis says.
Did you sweep us again?
He did not. He did not sweep us. Don't worry.
Oh, Bob, don't worry. Bob with that confidence. Here's how the movie ends.
That one is science.
Because Bob read it.
Good, good.
Oh, yeah.
So you knew for the you knew that one. So yeah, so this is interesting. It's interesting. I had to read this carefully because you know how sometimes, like as we talk about the data is one thing, and then they spin it a certain way, and that becomes the story. But okay, I think this one is reasonable as stated. So what the researchers did was they had subjects sort of play a computer game where they listened to clicks, and like one series of clicks would either be a little bit faster or a little bit slower than another series of clicks. And they had to say which one was faster of the two. But they also had to then say how confident were they in that judgment. And, you know, from 1 to 5, 1 being I'm just guessing and 5 is I'm absolutely sure. Right. So if you had one that was really fast and the one that was really slow, you'd say 5. 2 that were very close together, you might not really be able to separate them at all and mark that a 1. And then there was everything in between. And then they had a computer analyze it and do the same thing. And what they found was that the level of confidence in, you know, which series of clicks was faster actually followed a statistical pattern that it matched the computer's evaluation of statistically, like how much difference there was between those clicks, so that the people's subjective sense of confidence was fairly well, was matching, you know, essentially a statistical algorithm in terms of the difference between these clicks. Does that make sense?
So it
implied that at some subconscious level, the brain was actually processing, making statistical processing, you know, information processing. And, you know, the researchers are now interested in trying to find out, like, well, what part of the brain is that? What actually is it doing? Okay. Which one should we go to next? Let's go to number one.
Uh-oh.
I feel marginally better.
So,
oh, feel worse.
Following feel up worse. On prior predictions, astronomers report that direct observations support the existence of a distant ninth planet in our solar system. So maybe the key word here is that it supports the existence. Doesn't really say that we saw it, that we saw the planet.
Oh, just good point. Good
we
point.
We observed something that
shut
supports
up, Bob.
No, it's good, Jay. It's good for us.
But on the
no, it's bad. It's
Evan.
Bad.
Wait, wait,
but by the same token, if we look at number 2, in a recent study, every security software product tested actually lowered the level of security from the level already provided by browsers and operating systems. Evan hit upon the phrase there, every software product tested.
Oh, good point, Steve.
In that
good
study, yeah. Yeah.
Would you like to know how many were tested?
Yes, that'll reveal.
14. 14.
So 14.
It was a decent,
okay,
it was
I feel
a
like
decent,
we've got good odds.
Decent sampling. It was a decent sample. 14.
Otherwise, you know, why would they write if they only tested 3?
Yeah, yeah. Are you ready for the reveal?
Oh, God.
Never.
The astronomers reporting direct observations supporting a distant ninth planet in our solar system is the fiction.
Ah, yes. Bang.
Yes.
To the moon, Alex. So.
That's awesome.
Yeah, your instinct about you would have seen it.
Suck it.
Probably right. Except, you know, sometimes I catch things. I just happen to catch things, you know, right at the beginning of the news cycle before you guys do. But, and I certainly go for those. If I see, oh, they're going to think they would have seen this one.
Yeah,
I definitely would go for it.
I know.
So, yeah, there's no new, but you're right, Bob. It's going to take time, I think, before we can get any direct observations here. But this was based on a real news item. What astronomers did was a computer simulation trying to explain the alleged orbit of Planet Nine. And what they found was that it's pretty unlikely that a planet of that size would exist in that orbit. There's a couple of ways, or a few different ways, that the planet could get out there. One is it could have formed there from material that was already out there. You know, it's 10 times farther than the orbit of Pluto on average. It's also in a very elliptical orbit. But they say also it could have formed closer in and been dragged out there by a close approach to another star. And of course, early on in the life of our solar system, our star formed in a stellar nursery, right? Like most stars, which means that early in its life, there was lots of stars very close to us, and that probably knocked a bunch of our planets out of the solar system, you know, leaving us only with, you know, the ones that we have. But it may have also dragged a gas giant out into the outer reaches of the solar system, but not quite pulled it away. But they said there's, you know, the computer simulation showed there's only a 10% chance of that happening. 90% of the time, it'll get ejected from the solar system. But still, that, you know, what if there were 10 planets that happened to? I don't know. Most of them got ejected, and this is just the one that managed to stick around.
I'm so not paying attention.
This is the most fascinating news I've heard.
Yeah,
in the last 80 minutes.
This is yes, this is a computer simulation, and it's just no matter how that planet got out there, it's an unlikely scenario. Which makes it seem like there's probably not a lot of planets out there. Which does remember part of the skepticism about this planet was that if they, you know, they saw the evidence for it, they happened to be looking in the right direction. Then there must be a lot of them out there, but there probably isn't a lot of them out there.
Right, so right.
This supports the notion that there probably isn't a lot of them out there, but never. Still waiting for that direct observation to confirm its existence.
A couple years.
Yeah. Which means that in a recent study, every security software product tested, all 14 of them, actually lowered the level of security from the level already provided by browsers and operating systems. So that was, and the researchers were surprised by that. This is researchers at Concordia University. Senior editor, the senior researcher there was Mohammed Manin. What he said was that, you know, he suspected that there might be some issues with these products, but he was surprised that all 14 of them failed. So the example he gave is that, you know, when a browser contacts a website, that it asks for the security certificate or the certification authority, right? Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't get proper certification authority, then it treats it as an untrusted site. But what a lot of security software does is it's supposed to give you real-time protection from malicious websites. So it supersedes the browser's certification authority, you know, verification with its own, essentially telling the browser, don't worry, everything I give you is legitimate. And then it decides whether or not the website is legitimate. So it could actually, you know, bypass the browser security and allow for malicious, you know, software to get through or for websites to be contacted if it makes a mistake. So it actually, by bypassing the built-in security measures, they found that it adds new vulnerabilities and actually lowers the level of protection and security.
So you're saying that the anti-malicious software,
yeah,
the security software, is allowing backdoors and
yes,
penetration points for malicious software.
Because it's bypassing the baked-in security processes with its own, and you're better off just keeping your browser updated, keeping your operating system updated with all the security patches. That doesn't mean like you don't run, you know, I think it's the real-time protection that's the problem. And I don't use real-time protection myself because it slows things down. I don't trust it. But I don't think it means like you shouldn't run like an antivirus scan of your computer. But yeah, just don't run anything that sits on top and bypasses the built-in security measures. Now, they did say that they contacted the vendors and told them about these issues that they discovered so that they could fix them. But clearly if 14 out of 14 had these problems, clearly there's a serious issue here. And it's probably just, you know, it's a quality control issue. That's what it sounds like.
Steve, I find it hard to believe, though, if this is true, that security software developers don't know this.
Here's a quote. Out of the products we analyzed, we found that all of them lower the level of security normally provided by current browsers and often bring serious security vulnerabilities.
You know what makes me want to slip my wrists?
I read
that damn article. I knew they found flaws, but one, I did not remember that one stupid word, every. In my mind, in my completely fallible piece of crap memory, it was like most of them, not all. But then I was thinking, wait, Steve doesn't usually pull that, but I was like, no. All right, I'm done.
That's amazing.
Bob, you know what I find?
You know, that's
Amazing.
That catharticism is awesome.
I got over losing science or fiction about 4 or 5 minutes ago.
Yeah, but Jay.
Bob is
Jay.
Sitting there stewing. You know what makes me slip my wrists? Losing science or fiction.
No, you didn't listen to me, Jay. It's not losing. I could deal with that after a few hours. But when I actually read the stupid thing, that makes me look for the razor blade. Because I read that. I read that fucking piece of crap article. I read it. I read every damn word. And still I got it wrong. What is the point?
All right.
That was adorable.
Evan, give us a quote.
I have a quote. It was submitted by our friend Craig Good. Thanks, Craig. We appreciate Craig. It, as always. It is wrong always, everywhere, and for anyone to believe anything upon insufficient evidence. And that was said and or written by William Kingdon Clifford. Bob, any idea who William Kingdon Clifford was?
Did he write the Clifford kids books?
No, he didn't. He was a mathematician and philosopher from Britain. He was born in 1845, died in 1879. So he was only 34 years old when he died. But he influenced the non-Euclidean geometry of Bernhard Riemann and wrote On the Space Theory of Matter in 1876. Whoa. He presented the idea that matter and energy are simply different types of curvature of space, thus foreshadowing Albert Einstein's general theory of relativity in 1876.
Wow.
Very, very cool. And if you saw a picture of him, he kind of looks like Leonardo DiCaprio with a big Rasputin beard. That's the impression I got. Yeah.
And Evan, you didn't mention that he was born on May the 4th.
Oh my gosh, Steve, I should. Thank you for picking that up. Thanks for picking up the spare. Happy birthday.
Yeah. I like that quote, and I totally agree with it. I think, why believe anything that isn't supported by evidence? Why have belief?
You're here.
I'm not down with belief. So what's the point of it? What's the point of it?
Right.
I'm going to arbitrarily decide that I'm going to believe this, even though I can't just support it with logic or evidence.
Because it makes me feel good, I guess. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Latest win.
All right. Thanks, Evan.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure.
Yeah. Thanks, Steve.
Great episode.
And next week we'll be seeing each other at Nexus.
See you there.
Yes.
See you all there. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.